We're moving along through the book of 1 Kings. Obviously, much more time is going to be spent on Solomon's rule than on anybody else's in these historical books, other than David's. David and Solomon become the focus of these, because as we're looking at the history of the Israelite kingdom, they form the apex, they form the pinnacle, the greatest point of that kingdom. Everything before that, the period of the judges, the period of Samuel and Saul, were all preparatory to the periods of David and Solomon, under which Israel became the mightiest kingdom in the world at the time. And after that, everything starts to decline. And perhaps you've heard the old saying, once you're over the hill, what happens? You pick up speed, right? You pick up speed on the downhill side. And so even in the way the book is written, the narrative picks up speed. And so as we're heading downhill and as the kingdoms are deteriorating, the accounts tend to get shorter and shorter as the author moves us towards the culmination, which is the deportation to Babylon. So throughout both books, you're seeing the chronicling of the kingdoms of Israel as it rises and as it falls. And so we spent a lot of time in the early period of Samuel's life and Saul's life, and then we built up to David and Solomon. So the whole first book of 1 Samuel was building up. We looked at Samuel, and we looked at Saul, and we looked at the events surrounding their lives. And then we got to 2 Samuel with the coronation of David, and we continued all through that for the entire book of 2 Samuel. And now we hit Solomon, and for the first 10 chapters or so of 1 Kings, we're going to be covering Solomon. So we're at the pinnacle here, and especially with the construction of the temple. This is the peak of the Israelite kingdom. And even towards the end of Solomon's reign, things are going to start to decline. And so as it declines spiritually, the pace picks up with the transition of kings seems to go faster. And the accounts get a little bit shorter. It's not that the kings necessarily ruled shorter periods. In fact, one of the most wicked kings ruled the longest time. Manasseh was one of the most wicked kings to sit on the throne of the southern kingdom, and yet he was on the throne for 54 years, just about longer than anybody else. But as the narrative heads towards the deportation to Babylon, it picks up speed. And so our ancient writers were not strangers to methods of writing good stories, engaging stories. This is not just a mere repetition of fact. I don't know what your high school history teacher was like. My high school history teacher was the football coach. And I think they just needed to put him in a classroom to justify his being at the school. So he taught history. And you know what we did for 50 minutes every day? We copied his notes off of the overhead without a comment. He just read them, we looked at it, copied it down. Looked up, copied it down. And that's all we did for 50 minutes every day. And that was at least 1 year of my high school history class. Well, God didn't give us history that way. He gave us history in narrative form, which is a story, but not in the sense of an untrue story. It's not fictitious. It's what we would call a historical narrative. And so it is a story. It has plot. It has development. It has crescendos and decrescendos. It has all the elements of good storytelling, but it's also accurate history. So I know Ken Ham would yell at me for calling it a story, right? But it is, in a sense, a story in that it moves along like a well-written book, okay? You ever grab hold of a good, well-written novel and you just can't put the thing down and you realize it's like 4 in the morning and you've just been reading and reading and reading and you get into a good, engaging story like that and it just captures your attention? Well, these historical narratives were written to be like that. And so as we're covering Solomon, it's going to take the next few chapters to cover his reign. But after that, once we get to his son Rehoboam and the following, things will pick up speed and we'll cover a lot more time and a lot shorter amount of our time. But we get to chapter 7. Solomon has finished building the temple. And we looked at some of those pictures. Let me go ahead and bring that up just so that we can get an idea of it, or not, because I thought it was right there. Maybe it was on that memory stick that I just pulled out. It's often helpful to have pictures to look at some of these things, so let's see here. And, of course, it's not going to bring it up. There it is. There we go. So this is the illustration of Solomon's temple. We're going to come back to this because it has described the construction of Solomon's temple. It's going to now describe in tonight's study his own palace, but then the rest of chapter 7 is going to be taken up describing the furnishings of the temple, all of the utensils that were there, and that's an elaborate description as well. So we get here to 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 1. Solomon was building his own house 13 years, and he finished his entire house. How long did it take him to build the temple? Peter?
7 years,
that's right. Specifically, 7 years and 6 months. But he was 7 years building the temple. But we said last week that didn't necessarily include everything, because who helped him build the temple? God. Yeah. Yeah, lots of people. David. David especially. So towards the end, the last half of David's reign, David was stockpiling materials for the temple of God. He was helping get things ready. In fact, Solomon didn't have to spend a whole lot of time on the architectural plans for the temple because David already had them done. And that saves a lot of time in the building process. So when Solomon was ready to start building the temple, he was able to accomplish it fairly quickly. So we don't necessarily want to see here that Solomon is more worried about his own house than he is about God's house. That's not necessarily what's going on here, even though it took him 7 years to build the temple and 13 to build his own. Now, we should also see these as consecutive. He started building the temple. Does anybody recall which year of his reign he began that? Not the second. Keep going. It was the fourth. He began it in the fourth year of his reign, and it took 7 years. So he finished the temple in the 11th year of his reign. Then he started, probably the next year, building his house, and that took him 13 years. So by the time he's done building his house, we are 4 and 7 is 11 plus 13. We're 24 or 25 years into Solomon's rule. How long does Solomon rule on the throne? 40 years. So we've already taken up more than half of his reign in just these building projects. Now we know Solomon had other building projects going on at the time. He built aqueducts, he built cities, he built chariot stalls, he built armories. Solomon was a very busy guy. 13 years and he finished his entire house. And what follows is a description of what that house, that palace looked like. And it is spectacular. It is magnificent. He built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Its length was 100 cubits, and its breadth 50 cubits. So remembering, a cubit is how long? About 18 inches, so 1.5 feet. So you take the 100 cubits, multiply it by 1.5, this building is 150 feet long. That's pretty big. That's a pretty big structure. It is 50 cubits wide, which makes it 75 feet. So it's a nice rectangle. It's twice as long as it is wide, 150 feet long, 75 feet wide. That's a pretty big structure. And its height is 30 cubits, so it's 45 feet tall. Pretty big. And it was built on 4 rows of cedar pillars with cedar beams on the pillars. So here's the first inclination we get of why this thing is called the House of the Forest of Lebanon. It's not just because the trees came from Lebanon, but as you approach it, it's built on 45 pillars. So these pillars most likely would have been something like the trunk of a big tree, just stripped and smoothed. And so as you're walking up to the building, you have all of these pillars set in place. It would look like a forest as you're walking into it. Okay? It's big, so they called it the House of the Forest of Lebanon. So four rows of 45, four rows of pillars, 45 pillars, and on top of those are beams of cedar, because above those are rooms, storage rooms. As we look in verse 3, it was covered with cedar above the chambers that were on the 45 pillars, 15 in each row. Now, while the language here is a little tough for us to understand, this is not nearly the kind of description that we could reproduce this structure from. Even illustrations of it are tough for us to get. But you have to imagine that this building is sort of like a giant porch. It's a giant unenclosed area with all of these pillars sticking up out of the ground, and those are holding up storerooms above. And so you have all of these storerooms sitting on top of these pillars, and they're in rows. So it's possible that the house, or this structure, was like a courtyard, so that you had pillars going around, and you had the rooms on top going around, and in the middle was open. A lot of ancient architecture looks like this. Many of the houses would have rooms around and an open courtyard in the middle, where there would be gardens and fountains and things. So it's very possible. It doesn't the language doesn't demand it be that way, but you can sort of envision this is something like what it looks like. It's covered with cedar above the chambers that were on the 45 pillars, 15 in each row. There were window frames in three rows, and window opposite window in three tiers. So what we're talking about now is that probably the chambers on top of these pillars are stacked. Remember, we said in the temple that there was the temple proper, and on the outside of the temple were three tiers of storage rooms going up the wall. Similar idea here, where you have these beams or these posts holding up the floor of the bottom set of chambers, and then there's more chambers on top of those and more on top of those, so that you have this stacked look. So it really would look like trees, because you're coming up to this and you have the post holding up the floor, and then you have this stack of rooms on top of it, and each room has a window on each side of it to let air flow through. Would have been a magnificent looking house. All the doorways and windows had square frames, and window was opposite window in three tiers. So you have three tiers of storage rooms built on top of these things. There's some inclination, some of the words that he uses to describe this place tell us that he might have used this as an armory. I don't know how many of you have ever traveled to Williamsburg. I get it confused with Williamstown. Williamsburg, Virginia, and seen the colonial village that's there. Anybody ever seen that? It's pretty neat, isn't it? And they have the governor's mansion there, this massive house. And lining every wall in the building are swords and guns. And it's an amazing looking place. And as you go through, you say the house was used as the armory. And so if there were a need to defend the village, they would call everybody to the governor's house. You'd get your weapons from there. It wasn't just decorative. Those were functioning weapons in the day. I mean, just really every square inch of the place covered with weapons. It was beautiful. You know, it's what I want my house. No. That's something, this house of the forest of Lebanon may have been something of an armory, with shields and swords or spears hanging on the posts or stored in the rooms. It would have been a display of power as well as of the grandeur of Solomon's kingdom. Not just a beautiful building, but it would have had a function, something along those lines as well. So verse 6, the next building he builds, he made the Hall of Pillars. Its length was 50 cubits, its breadth 30 cubits, and there was a porch in front with pillars and a canopy in front of them. It's a short description. It's a little hard to picture what it is, but once again, we've got another building that apparently has a porch in the front, so there would be a rise as you go up to it, and it has pillars on it with a covered canopy. Would have been a place you could relax in the hot of the day because you're in the shade. But then once you go inside, it would have been another courtyard set up where there were pillars all around and rooms on the sides and an open courtyard in the middle. This is once called the Hall of Pillars. Verse 7, he made the Hall of the Throne where he was to pronounce judgment. even the hall of judgment. Creative name. This is the hall where I'm going to pronounce judgment, so let's call it the hall of judgment, right? This, it was finished with cedar from floor to rafters. So this third building would have been his throne room, the place where people would come to him to present their claims, their disputes. They had something similar to our tiered court system, where you would go to the local tribunal, which usually consisted of the elders of the city. So if you had a dispute, you would go to the elders of your city. If they couldn't figure it out, there would have been a district judge that would have handled matters, and so you would go to him. If he couldn't figure out, then perhaps it went to the king. So it's not just that everybody who had a need went to the king. That would just take up all of his time. So they had a tiered court system, much like we do today. And so this hall would be the place where he would welcome envoys from other nations. He would render judgments in criminal cases. He would render judgments in civil cases. It would probably be a place with anterooms where he would help plan battles or defenses or building projects. This would have been sort of the west wing of his royal palace. Probably also all of these three buildings, the House of the Forest of the Cedars of Lebanon, and the House of Pillars and the House of Judgment were all very close to each other, if not interconnected, because it's spoken of as his palace. Right? So verse 8, oh wait, I missed 7. Nope, I did. Verse 8, his own house where he was to dwell in the other court back of the hall was like workmanship. So this throne room, you would enter the throne room, and on the back of it, you could go through the back doors, and that's where his house would be, his own residence. That's where the royal family would live, at least the ones he wanted there at the time. I mean, by the time he marries 700 wives, how do you keep them all in one building? And so he would have had buildings all over Jerusalem for his royal family. But that one right behind the throne room is where he himself would live. And it says it was of similar workmanship, so it would have been completely paneled with cedar planks, just like the temple was, but the temple was then also gilded. Middle of verse 8, Solomon also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken in marriage. So we're still, by this point, we're about a fourth of the way, almost anywhere from a fourth to a half of the way through. And we're still talking about Pharaoh's daughter. She was the royal queen. She was the one that everybody looked at as his official wife. Now, he married all these other gals that we find out about later. But Pharaoh's daughter was the preeminent one in the family. We know this even today in cultures where men marry more than one woman. There usually is one that runs everything. And all of the other girls wind up being subservient to that. And the more wives you have, the lower down the totem pole they get. So that by the time you've got several wives, that last one is just she's just there to do the dishes and sweep the floors. And that's about all she's used for in the house. But this is Solomon's glory and grandeur. He builds these houses for himself or for Pharaoh's daughter. Verse 9 tells us a little more about the construction. All of these were made of costly stones, cut according to measure, sawed with saws, back and front, even from the foundation to the coping, and from the outside to the great court. The foundation was of costly stones, huge stones, stones of 8 and 10 cubits. Okay, so just to review here, Solomon's building these buildings, and the foundation stones are made out of stones that are 8 or 10 cubits. How big's a cubit? A foot and a half? That gives us stones anywhere from 12 to 15 feet in length. How do you move something that big? And don't say a backhoe or whatever you would. Yeah, I guess a backhoe wouldn't even move something that large, would it? They didn't have the cranes. They didn't have the machinery we had. How do you move something that large? It would have been. As I say to my kids, everything's possible when you have an endless supply of slave labor. Go ahead, Eldon. Yep. Whatever it was, we're still sort of in the dark about how the ancient peoples built what they built. But what they built is amazing stuff. They obviously had abilities that we have no idea about. So if you look at the buildings of the Egyptians, and you look at the buildings of the Mesopotamians and of the Israelites, and even the Romans, we're a little in the dark as to how they were able to accomplish these things. But that just tells you that ancient man was not as dumb as people want you to think he was. He was an intelligent creature, able to figure out an awful lot. So they were able to manufacture these things. And incidentally, one of the things that's always puzzled me is, you can see it here in this picture, we haven't described these two bronze pillars yet in the accounts before us, but I'm sure you all have read enough of your Old Testament to know there were two huge bronze pillars in front of the temple. Massive things. Solomon didn't even bother to weigh them. They were so heavy. How do you make that and then stand it up? What's that? But he specifically tells us that it was manufactured in the Jordan River Valley in the clay ground there. So you would dig the clay into the shape you want, shape it all nice, and then you would pour your molten bronze in there, let it harden, then you would dig it up, polish it up, and take it to where you want it. How do you transport these bronze pillars from the Jordan River Valley, 1,500 feet below sea level, up the mountains over 10 miles to Jerusalem, 1,500 feet above sea level, and then stand them up on end? That's a feat of engineering.
How do you get that much molten bronze?
Yes. That's a big pot, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Now, they're not solid, but it tells us that they're a span thick. So, I mean, this is bronze that's 4 inches thick. How do you melt all that? How do you pour that kind of thing? How do you dig that out in the sand? They obviously had some technologies that we've forgotten about. And so what they built is pretty amazing. Amazing stuff. So, however they did it, Solomon's house was built with stones that were finely polished. It says cut with saws and finished. They were well-polished stones building his house. And above, verse 11, above were costly stones cut according to measurement and cedar. So not only have you got the foundation stones are these brilliantly polished, beautiful stones, but also parts of the roof are made out of stone. Make you feel secure in your own house, you know, want to go to sleep in there just in case there's an earthquake, right? But they were able to build these structures that could support that kind of weight. It was amazing. The great court had three courses of cut stone all around and a course of cedar beams. So had the inner court of the house of the Lord and the vestibule of the house. Now, we talked about this wall last time because we said it's probably a wall about half height, three courses of stone with a cedar top to decorate it. And there was the inner court of the temple that the worshiping men were allowed to come into the outer court, and then that half wall separated the outer court from the inner court. Only the priests could go in the inner court. Inside the inner court was the altar of burnt offering, the bronze lavers, and then, of course, the temple proper. So Solomon apparently also had this half-height wall surrounding his own palace, these three buildings that we've just described, the House of the Forest of Lebanon, and the Judgment Hall, and the House of Pillars, were surrounded by a courtyard as well with this half-height wall. And so all of it made to look very, very beautiful. So we get to verse 13. Yeah, we got time. We'll go ahead and keep moving. Now we're going to talk about the temple furnishings. And we're going to talk about the layout. Well, you know what? Let me pause for a moment before we get to the temple furnishings. And we're going to go to this map. No. Where did it go? Wow, I lost them both. Okay. All right. Now, this is not the highest resolution map, but hopefully it's clear enough. This is a topographical map of Jerusalem. Okay. And so the dark places you see right here is the Kidron Valley. This Kidron Valley separates Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, which would be over here. So you have to descend a fairly deep valley and then ascend up to another mountain to get to Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem itself is somewhat in a bowl. The Olive Mountain is higher than Jerusalem, and all the surrounding mountains are somewhat higher than Jerusalem. So Jerusalem's not the highest peak there, but it is very, very central. So as you cross the Kidron Valley and then ascend this slope, this dark area, you come to the peak of two different places. Right here, this orangish, that's actually clearer on your screen than it is on mine. Good. This orangish area here is what was originally Jerusalem when David took it. It's also called Zion. All right. This is where David built most of his stuff. This is where the Jebusites inhabited. It's where the stronghold or the citadel was located. And as David built, they slowly went this direction up the narrow crest of the mountain. Right here is a familiar place. This is Mount Moriah. This is where Abraham offered his son Isaac, and this is where David saw the angel as it was bringing the plague to Jerusalem, and where he offered sacrifices to stop that plague. This is where the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite was, and this is where Solomon built the temple. So they would have constructed a very large retaining wall here to make this as flat as they could make it for the foundation of the temple, and the temple complex is up here on top of Mount Moriah. Right here is a familiar value, but it becomes more meaningful in the New Testament because this is called the Valley of Hinnom, or they often called it the Gehenna Valley. It becomes a picture of eternal judgment and hell in Jesus' parables because it was the trash dump. And they didn't just dump and bury their garbage like we do up there in Rockford. They would set it on fire. And so there were continual fires burning down there in the Hinnom Valley, consuming their refuge. Now, granted, I don't think they generated near the garbage that we generate without all the plastics and paper products that we use. But that was their garbage dump, their refuse dump. Up here is another valley that separates Zion from the western hill, and this is called the Tyropian Valley. Solomon's palace most likely was built right over here on this peak, because other descriptions from other historians that we have describe a bridge connecting the palace, the royal palace, with the temple complex. And so crossing over this valley, which is not nearly as big as the Kidron Valley, but there could have been a bridge crossing over from the palace here to the temple complex so that the king had direct access to the temple. And there are certain descriptions, such as when Josiah is king, that he goes up from the palace to the temple. So there was a connection there. So the temple's built here on the peak of Mount Moriah, and Solomon's palace, these three buildings, probably built over here on the northeast section of the western hill. Right? So hopefully, I like pictures. I like to draw pictures and look at pictures, so hopefully that helps you understand what's going on there a little bit. So back to the temple. Verse 13, King Solomon sent and brought Hiram from Tyre. He was the son of a widow of the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in bronze. And he was full of wisdom, understanding, and skill for making any work in bronze. And he came to King Solomon and did all his work. We're going to see why there needs to be so much bronze as we take a look at this picture of this temple. But Solomon not only was bringing timber and lumber from up north in Lebanon, but he also brings down this worker who is the son of a widow from Naphtali. And she married a man from Tyre. And so they have this son, Hiram, and he's exceptionally skilled in metalworking. And so he's going to come and help Solomon to build the furnishings of the temple. And so verse 15, he cast two pillars of bronze. Here's where we get into these huge pillars. 18 cubits was the height of one pillar. So that's how high? 24, 25 feet. That's pretty big. Bronze pillars, 25 feet tall. A line of 12 cubits measured its circumference. It was hollow, and its thickness was 4 fingers. So you could measure 12 cubits around it, so that's about 18 feet around. So this thing is, it's pretty big around, and it's 25 feet tall. And it's hollow inside, but the bronze is 4 fingers thick. So 4 or 5 inches thick. That's pretty solid stuff. Now we have trouble pouring metal today because it gets porous. We remember when I worked at Detroit Diesel, packaging up engine parts, there was a big to-do. The company had to set aside $25 million because one of their runs of piston heads was faulty. It developed air bubbles, and they were fracturing inside of the engines under the stress because they had air bubbles inside the steel. And somehow it got through quality control. Nobody noticed it. So they had to put together $25 million to repair all these truckers' engines that were blowing up because of these faulty piston heads, right? So I don't know what sort of repercussions it would have on a pillar like this to have air bubbles in it, or if it would develop. You know more about metallurgy than I do. Is that, would that be a problem with pouring molten bronze? Okay. All right. But these things are huge. And they're ornate. They're not just plain old pillars as we go through the description here. It's hollow. Its thickness was 4 fingers. The second pillar was the same, so he makes 2 of them. He made 2 capitals of cast bronze to set on the tops of the pillars. The height of the one capital was 5 cubits. The height of the other capital was 5 cubits. So we're 24, 25 feet tall just with the pillar, and then there's a decorative top on the pillar that's another 5 cubits, or 7.5 feet. So we're over 30 feet tall here with these pillars. And remember, the temple itself was 30 cubits tall. So these things are almost as tall as the temple itself. So the capitals, verse 17, there were lattices of checker work with wreaths of chain work for the capitals on the tops of the pillars, a lattice for the one capital and a lattice for the other capital. So you're describing the decorative nature of it, that there would have been pretty ornate work going around this thing, a lattice work like you might grow a grapevine on, or a rose bush or something. But then it had chains woven into it as well. So not only does Hiram have to cast these giant pillars, he's got to cast this lattice work, and he's got to cast these chains. You can see this is getting into a lot of work, right? Verse 18, likewise, he made pomegranates in 2 rows around the one lattice work to cover the capital that was on top of the pillar, and he did the same with the other. So he's got this lattice work, he's got the chains woven through it, but he's also got carved fruits cast in bronze to decorate this whole thing. And so going all around both of these pillars are these very ornate, very decorative capitals that were on the top. There were, verse 19. The capitals that were on the tops of the pillars in the vestibule were of lily work, 4 cubits. The capitals were on the 2 pillars and also above the rounded projection, which was beside the lattice work. There were 200 pomegranates in 2 rows all around, and so with the other capital. 200 of these carved fruits this guy made as he's working with the bronze. Once again, the descriptions are a little hard to wrap our minds around without having a picture. Some of you might be better at putting together a mental picture with a verbal description. I'm not all that great at it, but you can sort of imagine how ornate these pillars were, how beautiful they were. The whole point, once again, was to make this temple an ornate, glorious throne room for God, because he dwelt there. He sat on the mercy seat. He ruled Israel from this place, and so anybody walking in was supposed to be intimidated by the grandeur of the building. Just like they were when they approached Solomon's Hall, they were supposed to be intimidated and awed by the building itself. And so not only the shape of the building, the size of it, but also the decoration with these massive pillars were supposed to awe people. He set up the pillars at the vestibule of the temple. He set up the pillar on the south and called its name Jachin. And he set up the pillar on the north side and called its name Boaz. And on the tops of the pillars was lily work. Thus the work of the pillars was finished. These pillars are going to remain here for a very long time. They are going to be bastions, guards for the temple, up until the deportation to Babylon. So they're going to be there a very, very long time. Boaz and Jachin. And their names are going to be mentioned several times for us as well. But not only does he have these pillars here, verse 23, then he made the sea of cast metal. It was round, 10 cubits from brim to brim, and 5 cubits high, and a line of 30 cubits measured its circumference. Right down here is this sea that he's talking about. Okay, in front of the tabernacle was something called the bronze laver. It was a bowl made of bronze. It held water, and that's where the priests were to wash the sacrifices and get the water that they needed for ritual washings as they were ministering in the temple. Solomon built this thing, and it was so big and held so much water that they called it a sea rather than just a bowl. It's the kind of thing you want to eat your cereal out of when your mom says you can have just one bowl of cereal for breakfast, and you say, okay, mom, bam, here's my bowl. Right, pour in the Cocoa Krispies, I'm ready. Pick the biggest bowl you can find. This thing, look at the measurements of it. Try to recall your junior high school geometry, and we'll work through how big this thing is. All right, it's 10 cubits from brim to brim. Now, what's our mathematical measurement that we call from one edge of the circle to the other? That's your diameter, right? 10 cubits wide, so 15 feet across. Kids, that's about the size of your swimming pool that we set up in the summer, okay? 15 feet across. It's 5 cubits high. So we're talking about 7.5 feet tall, just the bowl part of it. We're going to see underneath of it, there's even more going on with the oxen, but it's 7.5 feet tall, so it's pretty big. Pete, would you like me to throw you in something that big?
Yeah!
Yeah! Especially if it's full of milk and cereal, right? Yeah, wouldn't that be great? Okay, so 15 feet wide, 7.5 feet tall, and a line of 30 cubits measured its circumference. Anybody remember junior high school geometry? How do you figure out the circumference of a circle? Tim, you're fresh into this. Do you know what it is? Pie is involved. Chocolate cream or pumpkin? Okay, no. All right, we know the mathematical term pi, 3.141 something. I got it to 3 digits, I think. Do you know it any farther? 3.15159. I was off. Okay. Gary's got to use this stuff probably all the time, right? Designing. What, used to? Used to. Yep. Had that number drilled into your head, didn't you? So... All right, so if you want to figure out the circumference of a circle, you take the radius, which is half the distance across, and you multiply it by 2 times pi, if I'm remembering this right. 2 pi r is the equation to find the circumference of a circle. So pi, 3.15, times 2 is 6.3. Now, our diameter... we said was 15 feet. Half of that is the radius. So now we're looking at 7.5 feet. So 6.3 times 7.5. You got your calculator out, Gary? 45-ish. 45-ish. How many? That's feet. We did measurements in feet. How many cubits is 45 feet? Right about 30. Hey, look, the text is right. It's mathematically accurate. Using round numbers, now it would be a little bit different, but using pretty round numbers, the text has given us accurate measurements. If you have a bowl that is 10 cubits across, you're going to have a circle around the outside that is right about 30 cubits. So he's giving us accurate descriptions. So you could do some quick calculations. How do you figure out the volume of a cylinder? Here's some fun stuff, right? Well, you take the circumference or the area of the circle, and multiply it by the height. So the area of a circle is pi r squared. Well, we're going to need a calculator for this one. Okay. You would take the radius, which is 5 cubits, and you would square it, which is 25, and then you would multiply it by pi, which is 3.15. So then you have Eldon, go ahead. Yes. Mm-hmm. Just to make sure it's perfectly round, right?
The worst part of this is about the time you got the thing in there to read it, something happened, you slipped out, and you knocked around.
Yep. I always hated that I'm measuring long stuff with my tape measure, and they keep telling you that these things will stand out on their own at 10 feet, but not a one of them does. So you're trying to stretch your tape all the way out to that long board, and it's just falling off the end, and you pull it back in, and you try again, and it falls off the other side. Right? Well, long story short here, you get the area of your circle of this thing, and you multiply it by the height of it, and Solomon tells us how much water this thing will hold. When we get down to, whoops, I got ahead of myself, didn't I? Oh, I lost it.
25.
Verse 25? Oh, yeah, there. Thank you. So, all right, so. End of verse 26. We'll cover the other stuff here in a minute. End of verse 26, it held 2,000 baths. A bath is about 6 gallons. So this thing is large enough to hold right around 12,000 gallons of water. That's a lot of water. This thing is big, so you can get to understand why they called it a sea instead of a bowl, a bronze laver. Now, the interesting connection for us is in Revelation, what does John see in front of the throne? A crystal sea. He's not talking about a giant expanse of water. He's talking about this giant bowl made out of crystal instead of bronze, so that as the glory of God shines forth from the throne, and that rainbow's above the throne, and all the lightnings are going forth out of it, and all the glory of God is shining, imagine what that crystal would do to that light and just scatter it everywhere. It would be beautiful to have this crystal sea in front of the throne of God. Probably bigger than the one Solomon built. Remember that both Moses and David got their patterns for the tabernacle and for the temple from God. They both tell us that. This was not a man-originated plan. God gave them the designs of these structures. He gave them the layout of it. And so much of what Solomon is constructing here is because that's the way it somewhat looks in God's heavenly throne. All right. So, I mean, even going to the cherubim inside the most holy place where the ark is, it's a picture of God's throne room. That around God's throne all the time are the cherubim singing his praises. So this sea is big. Under its brim were gourds. I'm back in verse 24. Under its brim were gourds for 10 cubits, compassing the sea all around. The gourds were in 2 rows. Cast with it when it was cast. So these aren't even welded on. They're part of the carving of the bronze. Now that's a pretty pretty impressive feat. And on the panels, I skipped down a couple verses. It stood on 12 oxen, 3 facing north, 3 facing west, 3 facing south, and 3 facing east. So this giant bowl is set upon these bronze statues of oxen. You can see that pretty clearly in our picture up here on the screen. Its thickness was a handbreadth, so you're talking about a brim this wide. Now, when you've got 12,000 gallons of water, you need something sturdy. Water's pretty powerful, it's very heavy. That's a lot of weight and a lot of pressure at the bottom of that, so they needed something thick to be able to support all that. Its brim was made like the brim of a cup, like the flower of a lily. Now, tell me what a flower looks like. What's a lily flower look like? When a lily flower opens, its petals sort of curve down like this, right? So we can imagine the brim of this thing curving outwards and under like a lily. So it would have been much like a teacup with a little brim around it. We'll go ahead and hold off there as we go through our description. Any questions?